Hey, Chaney, a good plan will be for us to jump him from the brush and hit him on the head with sticks and knock him insensible. Then we can bind his hands and feet with rope and take him back alive. What do you think? But Rooster was angry, and he only said, "Get on your horse." We resumed our journey in thoughtful silence, the three of us now riding together and pushing deeper into the territory to I knew not what. Dinner time came and went, and on we rode. I was hungry and aching, but I kept my peace, for I knew the both of them were waiting for me to complain or say something that would make me out a tenderfoot. I was determined not to give them anything to chaff me about. Some large wet flakes of snow began to fall, then changed to soft, drizzling rain, then stopped altogether, and the sun came out. We turned left off the Fort Gibson Road and headed south, back down toward the Arkansas River. I say down. South is not down any more than north is up. I've seen maps carried by immigrants going to California that showed west at the top and east at the bottom. Our stopping place was a store on the riverbank. Behind it, there was a small ferry boat. We dismounted and tied up our horses. My legs were tingling and weak, and I tottered a little as I walked. Nothing can take the starch out of you like a long ride on horseback. A black mule was tied up to the porch of the store. He had a cotton rope around his neck, right up under his jaw. The sun had caused the wet rope to draw up tight, and the mule was gasping and choking for breath. The more he tugged, the worse he made it. Two wicked boys were sitting on the edge of the porch laughing at the mule's discomfort. One was white and the other was an Indian. They were about 17 years of age. Rooster cut the rope with his dirk knife and the mule breathed easy again. The grateful beast wandered off, shaking his head about. A cypress stump served for a step up to the porch. Rooster went up first and walked over to the two boys and kicked them off into the mud with the flat of his boot. "Call that sport, do you?" said he. They were two mighty surprised boys. The storekeeper was a man named Bagby with an Indian wife. They had already had dinner, but the woman warmed up some catfish for us that she had left over. LaBeef and I sat at a table near the stove and ate, while Rooster had a conference with the man Bagby at the back of the store. The Indian woman spoke good English, and I learned to my surprise that she too was a Presbyterian. She had been schooled by a missionary. What preachers we had in those days! Truly, they took the word into the highways and hedges. Mrs. Bagby was not a Cumberland Presbyterian, but a member of the U.S. or Southern Presbyterian Church. I, too, am now a member of the Southern Church. I say nothing against the Cumberlands. They broke with the Presbyterian Church because they did not believe a preacher needed a lot of formal education. That is all right, but they are not sound on election. They do not fully accept it. I confess it is a hard doctrine, running contrary to our earthly ideas of fair play, but I can see no way around it. Read 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 13, and 2 Timothy chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. Also, 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 2, 19, and 20, and Romans chapter 11, verse 7. There you have it. It was good for Paul and Silas, and it is good enough for me. It is good enough for you, too. Rooster finished his parley and joined us in our fish dinner. Mrs. Bagby wrapped up some gingerbread for me to take along. When we went back out on the porch, Rooster kicked the two boys into the mud again. He said, "Where's Virgil?" The white boy said, "He and Mr. Simmons is off down in the bottoms looking for strays." "Who is running the ferry?"
"Me and Johnny."
"You don't look like you have sense enough to run a boat. Either one of you."
"We know how to run it."
"Then let us get to it."
"Mr. Simmons will want to know who cut his mule loose," said the boy.
"Tell him it was Mr. James, a bank examiner of Clay County, Missouri," said Rooster. "Can you remember the name?"
"Yes, sir."
We led our horses down to the water's edge.
The boat, or raft, was a rickety, waterlogged affair, and the horses nickered and balked when we tried to make them go aboard. I did not much blame them. LeBeef had to blindfold his shaggy pony. There just was room for all of us. Before casting off, the white boy said, "You said James?"
"That is the name," said Rooster.
"The James boys are said to be slight men."
"One of them has grown fat," said Rooster.
"I don't believe you are Jesse or Frank James, either one."
"The mule will not range far," said Rooster. "See that you mend your ways, boy, or I will come back some dark night and cut off your head and let the crows peck your eyeballs out. Now, you and Admiral Sims, get us across this river and be damn quick about it."
A ghostly fog lay on top of the water, and it enveloped us, about to the waist of a man, as we pushed off. Mean and backward though they were, the two boys handled the boat with considerable art. They pulled and guided us along on a heavy rope that was tied fast to trees on either bank. We swung across in a looping downstream curve, with the current doing most of the work. We got our feet wet, and I was happy to get off the thing. The road we picked up on the south bank was little more than a pig trail. The brush arched over and closed in on us at the top, and we were slapped and stung with limbs. I was riding last, and I believe I got the worst of it. Here is what Rooster learned from the man Bagby. Lucky Ned Pepper had been seen 3 days earlier at McAllister's store on the MK&T railroad tracks. His intentions were not known. He went there from time to time to pay attention to a lewd woman. A robber called Hayes and a Mexican had been seen in his company. And that was all the man knew. Rooster said we would be better off if we could catch the robber band before they left the neighborhood of McAllister's and return to their hiding place in the fastness of the Winding Stair Mountains. LeBeef said, "How far is it to McAllister's?"
"A good 60 miles," said Rooster. "We'll make another 15 miles today and get an early start tomorrow."
I groaned and made a face at the thought of riding another 15 miles that day, and Rooster turned and caught me.
"How do you like this coon hunt?" said he.
"Do not be looking around for me," said I. "I'll be right here." LeBeef said, "But Chelmsford was not with him?"
Rooster said, "He was not seen at McAllister's with him. It is certain he was with him on the mail hack job. He will be around somewhere near, or I miss my guess. The way Ned cuts his winnings, I know the boy did not realize enough on that job to travel far."
We made a camp that night on the crest of a hill, where the ground was not so soggy. It was a very dark night. The clouds were low and heavy, and neither the moon or stars could be seen. Rooster gave me a canvas bucket and sent me down the hill about 200 yards for water. I carried my gun along. I had no lantern, and I stumbled and fell with the first bucket before I got far and had to retrace my steps and get another. LeBeef unsaddled the horses and fed them from nose bags. On the second trip, I had to stop and rest about 3 times coming up the hill. I was stiff and tired and sore. I had the gun in one hand, but it was not enough to balance the weight of the heavy bucket, which pulled me sideways as I walked. Rooster was squatting down building a fire, and he watched me. He said,
"You look like a hog on ice."
I said, "I am not going down there again. If you want any more water, you will have to fetch it yourself."
"Everyone in my party must do his job."
"Anyhow, it tastes like iron." LeBeef was rubbing down his shaggy pony. He said,
"You're lucky to be traveling in a place where a spring is so handy. In my country, you can ride for days and see no groundwater. I have lapped filthy water from a hoof print and was glad to have it. You don't know what discomfort is until you have nearly perished for water."
Rooster said,
"If I ever meet one of you Texas waddies that says he never drank from a horse track, I think I will shake his hand and give him a Daniel Webster cigar."
"Then you don't believe it?" asked LeBeef.
"I believed it the first 25 times I heard it."
"Maybe he did drink from one," said I. "He is a Texas Ranger.
Is that what he is? Said Rooster. Well, now, I can believe that.
LaBeef said,
You're getting ready to show your ignorance now, Cogburn. I don't mind a little personal chaffing, but I won't hear anything against the Ranger Troop from a man like you.
The Ranger Troop, said Rooster, with some contempt. I tell you what you do. You go tell John Wesley Hardin about the Ranger Troop. Don't tell me and Sis.
Anyhow, we know what we are about. That is more than I can say for you political marshals.
Rooster said, How long have you boys been mounted on sheep down there?
LaBeef stopped rubbing his shaggy pony. He said,
This horse will be galloping when that big American stud of yours is winded and collapsed. You cannot judge by looks. The most villainous-looking pony is often your gamest performer. What would you guess this pony cost me?
Rooster said, If there is anything in what you say, I would guess about $1,000.
You will have your joke, but he cost me $110, said LaBeef. I would not sell him for that. It is hard to get in the Rangers if you do not own a $100 horse.
Rooster set about preparing our supper. Here is what he brought along for grub, a sack of salt and a sack of red pepper and a sack of taffy, all this in his jacket pockets, and then some ground coffee beans and a big slab of salt pork and 170 corn dodgers. I could scarcely credit it. The corn dodgers were balls of what I would call hot water cornbread. Rooster said the woman who prepared them thought the order was for a wagon party of marshals.
Well, said he, when they get too hard to eat plain, we can make mush from them, and what we have left we can give to the stock.
He made some coffee in a can and fried some pork. Then he sliced up some of the dodgers and fried the pieces in grease. Fried bread, that was a new dish to me. He and LaBeef made fast work of about a pound of pork and a dozen dodgers. I ate some of my bacon sandwiches and a piece of gingerbread and drank the rusty-tasting water. We had a blazing fire, and the wet wood crackled fiercely and sent off showers of sparks. It was cheerful and heartening against the gloomy night. LaBeef said that he was not accustomed to such a big fire, that in Texas they frequently had little more than a fire of twigs or buffalo chips with which to warm up their beans. He asked Rooster if it was wise to make our presence known in unsettled country with a big fire. He said it was Ranger policy not to sleep in the same place as where they had cooked their supper. Rooster said nothing and threw more limbs on the fire.
I said, Would you two like to hear the story of the Midnight Caller? One of you will have to be the caller. I will tell you what to say. I will do all the other parts myself.
But they were not interested in hearing ghost stories, and I put my slicker on the ground as close to the fire as I dared and proceeded to make my bed with the blankets. My feet were so swollen from the ride that my boots were hard to pull off. Rooster and LaBeef drank some whiskey, but it did not make them sociable, and they sat there without talking. Soon they got out their bedrolls. Rooster had a nice buffalo robe for a ground sheet. It looked warm and comfortable, and I envied him for it. He took a horsehair lariat from his saddle and arranged it in a loop around his bed. LaBeef watched him and grinned. He said, That is a piece of foolishness. All the snakes are asleep this time of year.
They have been known to wake up, said Rooster.
I said, Let me have a rope, too. I am not fond of snakes.
A snake would not bother with you, said Rooster. You are too little and bony.
He put an oak log in the fire and banked coals and ashes against it and turned in for the night. Both the officers snored, and one of them made a wet mouth noise along with it. It was disgusting. Exhausted as I was, I had trouble falling asleep. I was warm enough, but there were roots and rocks under me, and I moved this way and that, trying to improve my situation. I was sore, and the movement was painful. I finally despaired of ever getting fixed right. I said my prayers, but did not mention my discomfort. This trip was my own doing.
When I awoke, there were snowflakes on my eyes. Big, moist flakes were sifting down through the trees. There was a light covering of white on the ground. It was not quite daylight, but Rooster was already up, boiling coffee and frying meat. LaBeef was attending to the horses, and he had them saddled. I wanted some hot food, so I passed up the biscuits and ate some of the salt meat and fried bread. I shared my cheese with the officers. My hands and face smelled of smoke. Rooster hurried us along in breaking camp. He was concerned about the snow.
If this keeps up, we'll want shelter tonight, he said.
The beef had already fed the stock, but I took one of the corn dodgers and gave it to Little Blackie to see if he would eat it. He relished it, and I gave him another. Rooster said horses particularly liked the salt that was in them. He directed me to wear my slicker. Sunrise was only a pale yellow glow through the overcast, but such as it was, it found us mounted and moving once again. The snow came thicker, and the flakes grew bigger, as big as goose feathers, and they were not falling down like rain, but rather flying, dead level into our faces. In the space of 4 hours, it collected on the ground to a depth of 6 or 7 inches. Out in the open places, the trail was hard to follow, and we stopped often so that Rooster could get his bearings. This was a hard job, because the ground told him nothing and he could not see distant landmarks. Indeed, at times, we could see only a few feet in any direction. His spyglass was useless. We came across no people and no houses. Our progress was very slow. There was no great question of getting lost, because Rooster had a compass, and as long as we kept a southwesterly course, we would sooner or later strike the Texas Road and the MK&T Railroad tracks. But it was inconvenient not being able to keep the regular trail, and with the snow, the horses ran the danger of stepping into holes. Along about noon, we stopped at a stream on the lee side of a mountain to water the horses. There we found some small relief from the wind and snow. I believe these were the San Boys Mountains. I passed the balance of my cheese around, and Rooster shared his candy. With that, we made our dinner. While we were stretching our legs at that place, we heard some flapping noises down the stream, and LaBeef went into the woods to investigate. He found a flock of turkeys roosting in a tree, and shot one of them with his Sharps rifle. The bird was considerably ripped up. It was a hen, weighing about 7 pounds. LaBeef gutted it, and cut its head off and tied it to his saddle. Rooster allowed that we could not now reach McAllister's store before dark, and that our best course was to bear west for a dugout that some squatter had built not far from the Texas Road. No one occupied the place, he said, and we could find shelter there for the night. Tomorrow we could make our way south on the Texas Road, which was broad, and packed clear and hard from cattle herds and freighter wagons. There would be little risk of crippling a horse on that highway. After our rest, we departed in single file, with Rooster's big horse breaking the trail. Little Blackie had no need for my guidance, and I looped the ends of the reins around the saddle horn and withdrew my cold hands into the sleeves of my many coats. We surprised a herd of deer feeding off the bark of saplings, and LaBeef went for his rifle again, but they had flown before he could get it unlimbered. By and by the snow let up, and yet our progress was still limited to a walk. It was good dark when we came to the dugout. We had a little light from a moon that was in and out of the clouds. The dugout stood at the narrow end of a V-shaped hollow or valley. I had never before seen such a dwelling. It was small, only about 10 feet by 20 feet, and half of it was sunk back into a clay bank, like a cave. The part that was sticking out was made of poles and sod, and the roof was also of sod, supported by a ridge pole in the center. A brush arbor shed and cave adjoined it for livestock. There was a sufficiency of timber here for a log cabin, although mostly hardwood. I suppose, too, that the man who built the thing was in a hurry and wanted for proper tools. A cockeyed chimney of sticks and mud stuck up through the bank at the rear of the house. It put me in mind of something made by a water bird, some cliff martin or a swift, although the work of those little feathered masons, who know not the use of a spirit level, is a sight more artful. We were surprised to see smoke and sparks coming from the chimney. Light showed through the cracks around the door, which was a low, crude thing hung to the sill by leather hinges. There was no window. We had halted in a cedar break. Rooster dismounted and told us to wait. He took his Winchester repeating rifle and approached the door. He made a lot of noise as his boots broke through the crust that had now formed on top of the snow.